Good everyone, a warm welcome to the debate on Press TV. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Welcome to the show. The Trump administration has offered targeting a list of EU products for tariffs to counteract the harm from EU subsidies for Airbus worth $11 billion. In reaction, the European Union has proposed tariffs on $20 billion worth of American goods. Now, this after the World Trade Organization announced the U.S. had failed to remove some Boeing subsidies. In April, the EU gave the go-ahead to plans for trade talks with Washington in order to reduce trade barriers. Both the United States and the European bloc have introduced lists of goods for consultations, and both of them are saying that they're awaiting a WTO arbitration to decide how much action to take. How seriously can Washington's unilateralism and trade policies exacerbate the already tense global trade? What's future holding for global trade? Let's put those questions to debate and much more. Now, joining me tonight will be David Barkin, Professor of Economics from Mexico City, and also Dean Henderson, political commentator, who is joining us out of Missouri. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Now, beginning with David, European Commissioner responsible for trade says that Europe wants a fair competition which is on equal terms. He also stressed that they don't want a tit for tat, but they have to be prepared for countermeasures if there is a way out. Is there a way out?
I think that at the present juncture, there is no way out. This is a long festering point of conflict between the two regions of the world. And the United States has argued systematically that it does not provide subsidies to Boeing. And the European Union, in turn, argues a similar position. The WTO conflict resolution panel has come up on numerous occasions over the past two decades with findings that show that both countries are providing different kinds of subsidies, some of them direct, but mostly indirect subsidies to the nature of the development of these planes. But the underlying problem isn't Boeing or Airbus. The underlying problem is the nature of the relationship between the two countries. And right now, the vision of what is the role of each country within the world economy. And it's there that I would like to focus. Trump has argued that the whole world is taking advantage of the United States, and that the only way to confront this problem is by abrogating many of the free trade agreements over the past several decades. The EU, on the other hand, has been advancing on an agenda of promoting greater free trade within the notion that more trade will benefit its producers, but more importantly, its consumers.
Okay, let's go to Missouri. Dean, President Trump has tweeted that, I'm quoting him, the EU has taken advantage of the U.S. on trade for many years. It will stop soon. Directly, it will soon stop, in his own words. Now, how has Europe taken advantage of the U.S.? What gives Trump, reason to speak so confidently regarding his plan that this will stop?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Europe has taken advantage of the U.S., and I don't think the U.S. has taken advantage of Europe. And I don't think, you know, Trump's going to be confident even if he's not. But I think the bigger question here is, you know, who benefits from free trade? Where did free trade come from? You know, free trade was a concept that came from the City of London, the old British mercantilist model, with the Freemasons at the spiritual center of it, with free ports in the Bahamas and Liberia where they wouldn't have to pay taxes, with freehold real estate laws, free trade, really. So, yeah, free for consumers, no. Free for producers, no. So all these trade agreements with the WTO at the center, the spider in the middle of the web, have created this globalized economy where capital can be mobile and can go global and can organize, but labor cannot. And so who's really taking advantage of the US consumers and the EU consumers is not either one of the US or the EU, but the corporations who are owned by these bankers who made these laws. And so in my view, it's not even really a dispute between the US and the EU. It's a dispute about, the real discussion should be, why are we subsidizing a multinational corporation like Boeing? Why are the people of the EU subsidizing a huge multinational corporation like Airbus, who probably have the same shareholders for all we know? There's a mm-hmm. good chance of it. And that's the real question. And all of this kind of fake nationalism is, I mean, it's pretty funny because, you know, I don't think Trump has a clue what he's doing, but in a way it's good because the tariffs are gonna force corporations to actually pay two governments, whether it's the EU government or the US government. We're gonna all get revenue. The state is gonna be made more powerful, and the corporations and the transnational capital is gonna be weakened through this process of trade wars and tariffs. And so I think it harkens back to the founding of America, when the East India Company came over here and tried to just dump their tea in Boston on us and suppress the price of our products. And the Tea Party was all about demanding that we put tariffs on the East India Company. It wasn't some right-wing, thing that the alt-right has adopted. It was actually a very left-wing notion that when we have to tax and we have to put tariffs on these giant transnational corporations, and so that way Americans and Europeans alike won't have to pay as much in taxes, won't have to carry the load for these bankers and their corporate tentacles.
Well, let me ask David the same question. David, has Europe been taking advantage of the U.S. all these years?
I would like to continue on Dean Henderson's response, because I think that he's hit the proverbial nail on the head. The question isn't whether countries are taking advantage of each other, but who are the beneficiaries? Mm-hmm. And Henderson has clearly and correctly identified the large corporations as the major benefits of that. And we have seen a systematic secular decline in the quality of life of workers within the corporations that are involved in these free trade agreements. The particular decline is in the United States, is in the Rust Belt. The European workers have been able to protect themselves somewhat better because they have been able to work with their political parties to construct social security networks. Those, in some cases, are under strong attack. We have seen that particularly strong in the case of Greece and now in Italy. So the real question, it seems to me, isn't whether who's better off, the U.S. or Europe, but rather what has happened to the workers? What has happened mm-hmm. to the quality of labor in the United States? And that is leading to a major political problem in the United States, because free trade, as the U.S. understands it, has to also involve the agricultural sector, the fruit, especially the fruit and produce sector. Mm-hmm. And they are dependent extraordinarily on immigrant labor. And immigrant labor right now is the boogeyman mm-hmm. in the Trump mm-hmm. equation. So I think that what we're seeing now from the United States point of view, and I really want to emphasize this, is mm-hmm. this struggle is about Donald Trump's re-election campaign.
Uh-huh. Right. Dina, both sides, both the U.S. and the European Union, are awaiting a WTO arbitration. Which side is more likely to benefit from that arbitration?
Yeah, well, that's anybody's guess, really. I wouldn't get into the world of the WTO and how they decide things. First of all, the verdict is very often not fair. And, you know, second of all, I guess, you know, it probably just depends, got more in their pocket or under their thumb. But it probably might go to the EU because Trump is just so unpopular with this literati crowd, as he is with most people around the world, and rightfully so. But it's just, I feel like Trump just stumbled upon this, and I'm not sure why he's doing it. But, you know, for whatever reason, my whole emphasis is just seeing this global free trade mechanism, this globalization towards this new world order, completely controlled by an oligarchy of 1% from the city of London and Washington and Wall Street, to come to its knees. And I think in some great accident, you know, even a clock is right twice a day. And in this case, Trump has stumbled upon something with these tariffs and starting this kind of trade war with China and with the EU, so-called trade war, which again, really affects just the corporations, so that Apple computer can't make a phone in China for $8 and sell it into the US market for $1,000. They might actually have to pay a $100 tariff to get that phone in and make it $108 therein. So, you know, boo-hoo, Steve Jobs has to take a pay cut or something like that. But Bezos or one of these guys, but I don't know who they're gonna come down on the side of, but I think the bigger point is that we need to get rid of the WTO. We don't want a supranational entity controlled by corporations, in this case, founded by Peter Anschutz of Cargill Corporation, the biggest grain company in the world, privately owned by the Cargill and McMillan families, controls 50% of the global grain trade, whether it's orange juice from Brazil or cotton from Egypt or, you know, wheat from the Midwest. They control all the shipping down the Mississippi River in this country. Huge corporation, most people never heard of it. And right. And we don't want this entity, this supranational entity, to have more power than the nation states of the world. And who this is really going to help in the end will be the third world so-called countries, because they're the ones that have never been allowed to develop, because the Western countries have always subsidized these big corporations. And then on the other hand, they'll put tariffs on cocoa from Ghana, or they'll put tariffs on bauxite from Jamaica. And hurt those producer countries. So it's all about the producers becoming more powerful by diminishing the power of the corporation and the banks, and by enhancing the power of the state, which can regulate those entities and help the working people and help to rebuild a middle class, which, yes, the British aristocracy, they don't like that. They want a parasite financial capitalist system where you extract wealth like the old East India Company from, you just take nutmeg from Indonesia and you leave those people with nothing. And this is the model that we've been following here for really for the last 30, 40 years, and it needs to change.
Right. Now, David, there are some experts who are concerned about the Trump administration's trade practices, and that they fear those could jeopardize global trade. How rightful a concern is that?
Well, I don't think that it's a question of it might. It's already jeopardized global trade. The real global trade, the growth in trade among nations has slowed, and in some cases has actually declined as a result of this vision that Trump and his cohorts have about the way in which the world economy works. What is very, very important is that it's leading to a realignment of international powers. You have China with its Belt and Road policy actually going out and stimulating production in Southeast Asia. You have the Latin American countries increasing their trade among themselves, but also looking to China as a potential buyer. And you have China trying to, well, not trying, actually building infrastructure in literally dozens of countries around the world. So what you have is a realignment that perhaps was happening before Trump.
Yeah, but Iran, Trump, Turkey, and Russia are also doing the same thing. Yep.
Yeah. So, so what you have is a realignment, and clearly, a new understanding of what international relations should be. The real question is, will this give an opportunity to improve standards of living of workers in all of these affected countries? Certainly, up to now, it hasn't done so in the United States.
Right. Now, Dina, is it reasonable to draw a parallel between Washington's trade dispute with Beijing and that with the European Union?
Yeah, I think it's the same dispute. And again, the dispute, I don't believe, is between China and the United States per se, or the EU and the United States per se. I think the dispute is this tension that's been building for so long between working people and capital. And China has become, you know, we can sing the accolades of China, I guess, all we want, and the Silk Road and how great it is. But the bottom line is China has become this low slave wage platform for Apple Computer, for the U.S. Silicon Valley tech industry. It's not as autonomous as you might think from the United States. It's definitely not as autonomous as you might think from the City of London crowd, who built all this stuff up in China from their Hong Kong base through HSBC bank financing. And so it's not a dispute between those countries. It's a dispute, again, between capital and labor. Now, are we going to continue to allow the Chinese government, the Chinese low-wage platform, to be utilized by every corporation on the planet to exploit those people and make a bunch of money exporting things made in China all over the world? And so there used to be this thing called autarky. A few countries tried it. I think Guinea was one of them. It's similar to Iran's resistance economy. You know, you have to stimulate domestic production in countries if you're ever going to get a standard of living back for the middle class. You have to have manufacturing. You can't live on a service economy where, you know, yeah, everybody makes things in China. We spread it all over the world, waste a bunch of fuel, waste a bunch of resources, shipment around the world, exploit those people. And then everybody in the modern Western world becomes a service worker, whether it's in the restaurant industry or the financial services industry, or, you know, basically cleaning the toilets of the rich. And this is what this whole global economy has become. It's an economy of cleaning toilets for the rich, you know, and it's got to change. And so the dispute, hopefully the leaders of these countries can someday become enlightened enough to realize that they've been set against each other, that their power has been diminished as a nation state, and that they are being set against each other by these corporations, and that they need to dismantle the mechanism that was used to set them against each other, which was free trade.
Okay, let me ask David, he's busy with his phone. David, the EU is saying it welcomes formal discussions with the United States, provided there are no preconditions, and Europeans say they don't favor a trade war, and provided there is good faith on both sides, a solution can be found. Is there good faith on the part of Washington? If they sit for negotiations, what could come out of them?
I think that what you just said puts, again, the issue changes the nature of the issue. Good faith. I think that we have to understand what Trump is doing right now as a political strategy as part of his reelection campaign. And if such, then we cannot assume that there's good faith on the part of the United States.
Uh-huh. I see. What's your opinion, Dean?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, we're talking about good faith, if there is good faith on the part of the U.S., if it is going to enter negotiations with the EU over this problem.
Yeah, I don't think there's that kind of enlightened understanding of the situation. So, no, I don't think there's any good faith. I don't think there's a lot of good faith on the other side either, because the leadership of the EU is really not much different than Trump. They're a lot more careful what they say, and they're a lot more polished at how they say it. They don't tweet as much. But let's face it, all these people are under the thumb of the international bankers, and that's why they're in office. And that's why Italy got in trouble, and that's why Greece got in trouble, and that's why Iran's in trouble, Syria's in trouble, Venezuela's in trouble, and the Sudanese government was just overthrown because they weren't under the thumb of the international bankers. So again, we can talk all about how we've been to free trade, boo-hoo, it's gonna hurt people, it's such a big deal. I hope it ends. I hope free trade's all over. I hope they throw a wrecking ball into this whole thing.
Speaking of the future, Dean, sorry to jump in. We have only 1 minute. Talking about the future, you just mentioned, given the circumstance these days, what do you foresee will happen to global trade? You have 30 seconds each. Let Dean go ahead.
Yeah, I think the era of free trade is coming to an end. It's not going to be pretty. There's going to be a lot of misunderstanding about it, a lot of fingers pointed in different directions about it. Trump's a perfect unpopular guy to be punching bag, fine with me, I don't like him. But for whatever reason, I think it's bigger than Trump. I think it's been coming for a long time. I think that's one of the reasons he was elected was the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He promised to end it, and he did. And I think the era of free trade is coming to an end. I think that's a good thing.
All right, David?
I think that it's too soon to put the tombstone on free trade. I think that free trade will become realigned among different countries, and I think that the United States will cease to become the center of the global dynamic for trade among countries. But the search for improving the quality of life of people in many parts of the global South will depend upon their ability to find fair trade partners throughout the global South.
All right, thank you for that. Let me appreciate our guests who joined us. We had David Barkin, professor of economics from Mexico City, and also Dean Henderson, political commentator, who joined us out of Missouri. I should also thank you for watching this program. We'll see you soon.